Good morning. Welcome to week two of Fairway in Quarantine, now Fairway Sheltering in Place. So I hope this finds you well. I do want you to know we've been checking on people in our church. Actually, it's March 29th for those of you who are confused. And we're glad you tuned in to YouTube today to watch what's going on here at the church. I do want you to know that we have been checking on folks throughout our congregation. And so far, everyone is doing well. No one is, of course, sick. And no one has need of groceries or supplies. We are grateful for all those who have volunteered to help in that way. And we're continuing to check on people. But as of now, nothing for you to do in that way of service. We can still pray for each other. There are a good number of people who are affected financially, either their job being cut back or being eliminated altogether for a period. And so please be in prayer for those. Even if you don't know their names, just go ahead and pray for our church family in that regard. Then a lot of people are anxious and scared and nervous, and we'll address that in just a bit. But we did want you to know that everyone is doing okay as far as we know here at the church. Now, this is very weird. If you're comfortable with this setup, then I'm not sure what to say to you, because this is exceedingly strange, us not gathering together, doing everything we do by video or by website or by Facebook. It's odd walking down the children's hall and not hearing laughing or crying or screaming. That's just the workers too that exhibit that behavior. So it's a little odd not to hear that. Come on, that was funny. Okay, good. All right. So that's odd. It's odd not going into the FLC and smelling coffee. The place is deserted. And so it's very odd that our family is not able to gather together. But in the interest of safety and of the health of our congregation, we're going to continue this policy. The elders will actually meet tomorrow morning virtually. We're not gathering together. But we'll be meeting online and discussing how far out to extend the cancellation of our activities. My guess off the top of my head would be at least through the month of April, but we'll be posting details on the website sometime Monday, so you'll want to be sure and check there for what's going on. So the elders have decided, one update I want to give you based on what's been going on here is the elders have decided that we want to invest in you, to resource you with the things that you will need to continue to grow in Christ, to continue to be fed, even in this time where we're not meeting together. So I'm going to ask you to watch this short video, and then I'll come back after it's done.
Welcome to our study of the Gospel of John.
I have fallen in love with the work of Paul as I've studied the book of 1 Corinthians, and I believe you will too.
This is where Jesus taught in Capernaum. And you have to understand this scene.
The Lord is my shepherd. And over the next 6 weeks, we're gonna look deeply into the 23rd Psalm.
Right Now Media. It's for groups. It's for personal devotion. It's for parents.
The bullseye of parenting is to raise children who become like Jesus.
It's for kids.
This is Phil. We're digging into the Bible, which, as we've mentioned, is more than just a book.
It's for tough times.
So when you recognize that you're trying to have a conversation with your spouse and they're not ready to talk, it's not helpful to keep pressing
right.
them.
It's for every phase of life.
If you've made mistakes with money, you know what that makes you? Over 12.
And now, it's yours. We've purchased a Right Now Media subscription for everyone in our church. So check your inbox for the digital invitation and download the app for instant access to thousands of biblically based videos. Get equipped. Get inspired.
All right, church, so we're providing you with the complete subscription to Right Now Media, their entire library of thousands and thousands of titles, videos, both of entertainment and of Bible study across all kinds of topics, from parenting to finance to Bible studies by books to topical studies. Anything you could want, they have on there, and the church is partnering with Right Now Media to provide all of that to you. So this afternoon, be looking for an email from Right Now Media with instructions on how to log in And if you don't get one, it's because we don't have your email address. So send your email address to me at elders@fairwaybaptist.com, and I'll get you the instructions to log on and set up your own account there on Right Now Media. But we're excited to offer this to you. Some of you are familiar with it. Fairway has used it in the past, and it's just a great resource. You can use it however you see fit to kind of fill in the gaps here when you're not able to meet. There are no women's ministry studies or men's breakfasts, or of course, no life groups are meeting. So everything you get now is going to be based on your own study for the most part, and this is a tremendous resource to help you with that. So be looking for that email from Right Now Media. Okay, today, just a short Bible study for you. Again, instead of going to Ephesians, I want to take you to the book of Psalms. And we're going to be in Psalm chapter 57. Now, the Psalms have been a special place for me to go during times of trouble, during times of anxiety. Most of my issues have all been related to health, and during the most, really the darkest hours in my journey through poor health, it was the Psalms. They were a tremendous encouragement to me. And I've read some great authors that have written on the Psalms, people like Sinclair Ferguson, who wrote a tremendous book on whether God could have abandoned me. And James Montgomery Boyce, who also wrote just a little pamphlet on some of the Psalms and a way to find solace in them in times of trouble. And so today I want to take you to Psalm 57, and we're just going to spend a few minutes looking at that and seeing what we can glean from the psalmist today. So Psalm chapter 57, it's a short, it's only 11 verses. We'll read the whole thing. Be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge. Till the storms of destruction pass by, I cry out to God Most High, to God who fulfills his purpose for me. He will send from heaven and save me, and he will put to shame him who tramples on me. God will send out his steadfast love and faithfulness. My soul is in the midst of lions. I lie down amid fiery beasts. The children of man, whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. They set a net for my steps. My soul is bowed down. They dug a pit in my way, but they have fallen into it themselves. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and make melody. Awake, my glory. Awake, O harp and lyre. I will awake the dawn. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations. For your steadfast love is great to the heavens, your faithfulness to the clouds. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. Psalm 57. Now, this psalm is a part of a collection of psalms that really describe sort of the early days, the early desperate period of David's life, a time when he was forced to flee into the wilderness to escape Saul. Psalm 52 really begins this set of psalms, and it refers to Doeg the Edomite, telling Saul that David had gone to Nob and had been helped by Ahimelech the priest. Because of this betrayal by Doeg, Ahimelech and 84 families, 84 of the priestly families, were murdered by Saul. Psalm 54, you can look at, is another one of these psalms. It tells of David's betrayal by the Ziphites. And these were his countrymen who should have supported him, but yet they betrayed him. Worst of all, maybe, is Psalm 56. Psalm 56 describes David's desperate times in the Philistine town of Gath, where he went to alone, desperate, and afraid. After he left Gath, David kind of faded into the wilderness, and he found himself hidden in a large cave known as Adullam. And this is where Psalm 57 gets its title. In the title of the psalm, it may just say when he was in the cave, or it may actually give the name of the cave in your translation. So David was there alone, at least in the beginning. But later on, it says in 1 Samuel 22 that while he was at Adullam, and his brothers and his father's household and all who were in distress or debt or just discontented came and joined him there. And it ended up being around 400 men. And David became their leader. But there's nothing really in Psalm 57 to indicate that this has already happened. Even though it may not have happened yet, this is clearly a turning point in David's journey. There's a very noticeable change in the tone of this psalm versus the ones that come before it. The earlier psalms, all the way back to Psalm 52, seem uncertain and fearful and desperate. And those words may describe the way some of you are feeling right now. But Psalm 57 is settled. It's confident. The prevailing note is one of praise as you read through the entire psalm. So what makes the difference? Why is it different? Well, in the earlier psalms, it's clear that David is hiding from his enemies. Here in Psalm 57, he's hiding in God, it said, which is really what that cave comes to symbolize. So hiding in God is what Psalm 57 is all about. And you could, if you were to study this psalm on your own, break it down into three sections. That's possible. You could look at Psalms 57 verses 1 through 3 as God's call to mercy. That's clearly what he's doing, is calling out to God for mercy. The second part could be verses 4 through 6, which is really a description of the problems that David is facing, the enemies that are after him. And then finally, there's a concluding praise section, if you will, verses 7 through 11. The reason I don't like that breakdown is in the middle of this and at the end of the chapter, there is a refrain or a chorus that David repeats, and it really makes the psalm better divided into two parts with that chorus coming at the end of each part. So it's more like a song. The first verse is really a confident cry for a deliverance, if you will. I mean, he doesn't sound too in despair. He sounds very confident as he calls out to God to protect him and to deliver him from his enemies. And the second half is a resolve, if you will. He's resolving in his own soul to praise God for that deliverance that he asked for in the first part of the chapter. In fact, verses 7 through 11 may not sound new to you. They are used almost word for word as the opening verses of Psalm 108. So David uses these words of praise in other places in the Bible. Let's take a look at a couple of the specific phrases in this psalm, and then we'll get into how it's divided, how it's structured, and see what we can learn from that. The first part of the psalm begins with David asking for mercy, even as he takes refuge in God. Now, the title of this psalm refers to this cave at Adullam. And so it may be natural for you to think that the cave is actually his refuge, that that's what he's thankful to God for, is for finding refuge for him in this cave. But we should notice that David doesn't call the cave his refuge. Even though it was, of course, a refuge in sort of a physical sense, rather it is God who he calls his refuge. In fact, at the end of verse 1, he uses some imagery, and that is under the shadow of the wings of God. Here's the point. I want you to notice how prominent God is throughout this psalm. And so if it's prominent in the psalm, it had to have been prominent in the mind of the writer of the psalm, our young fugitive, David. In this psalm, God is referenced some 21 times in both pronoun and by name. And there are other words like refuge and shadow of your wings that refer to him as well. Now, shadow of your wings is a particularly rich image. Let's spend just a minute on that. It can really be interpreted one of two ways. The first is the wings of the cherubim. The most frequent Old Testament usage of the word wings is to refer to the wings of the cherubim atop the Ark of the Covenant. And you know that the Ark of Covenant was kept in the most holy place, the Holy of Holies, in either the tabernacle and then later the temple. And atop that were two giant golden cherubim with their wings facing forward and touching in the middle. There's one on each end of the ark. You can see a description of that in Exodus 35, if you'd like to read up on that. Also, Exodus 37 and in 1 Kings chapter 6. It's also referenced in passages like 1 Chronicles 28, 2 Chronicles chapter 3 and chapter 5, the book of Ezekiel, and even in the New Testament, in Revelation chapter 4, verse 8, talk about the wings of the cherubim on top of the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the tabernacle and all of its divinely appointed furniture would be very prominent in the minds of the religious Jewish community. And so David could have been thinking of the wings of the cherubim, especially since the wings of the cherubim in the temple actually represented the place where God symbolically dwelt. And if that's what he meant, it's as if David was saying, I'm as safe here as I am in the Holy of Holies itself. The problem, of course, is that Psalm 57:1 doesn't speak of the wings of the cherubim. However significant they may have been in the minds of David or his Jewish readers. But he speaks of your wings, meaning the wings of God. It's more reasonable, therefore, I think, as we're reading this passage, to attribute to this phrase the same meaning that Jesus used it in Matthew chapter 23. So Matthew chapter 23, verse 37 says, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it. How often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you were not willing. So the phrase shadow of your wings that occurs here in Psalm 57:1 is also in Psalm 17:8, 36:7, Psalm 61:4, and 63:7. So it's pretty commonly used. But also in Psalm 91, the passage we read last week, in verse 1, that phrase becomes shadow of the Almighty. But verse 4 says this, if you'll recall, He will cover you with His pinions, and under His wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness is a shield and a buckler. Now, in the second part, the second stanza, if you will, of this first half of the psalm, and I'll try to clear that up later as we talk about the structure, David refers to God as God Most High. This wording, I think, is really connected with the next phrase. It says, who fulfills His purpose for me. Now, this is what David needed, was for God to fulfill His purpose for David, which He did. He delivered David from Saul, and then later delivered Saul into David's hand. Not just once, but twice, if you want to read in 1 Samuel chapter 24 and 26. This should be our prayer. Even during uncertain times like this, our prayer should be for God to fulfill His purposes for us, individually, as a family, and as a church. Verse 4, again in the first half of this psalm, opens with, My soul is in the midst of lions. Now, it seems like in these desperate early days of David's life, in his running from Saul, wherever he went, he seemed to be in the midst of lions. But when he lay down in the cave of Adullam, under the shadow of God's wings, he was as safe as Daniel was in the midst of his lions, in the lion's den. In fact, if David had lived after Daniel and had access to Daniel's writings, he might have said to King Saul, My God sent His angel and shut the lions' mouths, and they have not harmed me, because I was found blameless before him and also before you, O king. I have done no harm. That's Daniel chapter 6, verse 22. So let's take a little time right now and discuss the structure of the psalm, because I think that will inform your understanding a lot. We're going to take a look at the two halves. We're going to save the chorus or the refrain for last. So generally speaking, both the first and the second half of the psalm have the same themes in them. But there's a difference when they are mentioned in the second part. All right, so let's look at the general subject matter of the three stanzas, if you will, of the first half of the book. Stanza number one is verse 1. Be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for in you my soul takes refuge. In the shadow of your wings I will take refuge till the storms of destruction pass by. So this is an appeal for mercy coupled with a resolute determination to take refuge in God. That's verse 1. Excuse me, let's call it a stanza, because when I say verse, I mean the verse in the Bible. So that's stanza 1 of the first half, and it's found in verse 1. So verses 2 and 3 of Psalm 57 actually form the second stanza of this song, if you will. I cry out to God Most High, to God who fulfills His purpose for me. He will send from heaven and save me. He will put to shame him who tramples on me. God will send out His steadfast love and His faithfulness. So these two verses are a testimony to God's faithfulness to David. All right? Verse 4 is the third stanza of the first half of the book, of the chapter. Verse 4, my soul is in the midst of lions. I lie down amid fiery beasts, the children of man, whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords. So this is a description of David's enemies and of the danger that he is in because of them. So now if we look at part 2 of the psalm, we'll see the same exact themes, but in inverse order. Does that make sense? He's going to reverse the order that he talks about them. So the first stanza of the second part is in verse 6. They set a net for my steps. My soul was bowed down. They dug a pit in my way, but they have fallen into it themselves. This passage deals with David's enemies, which is what the third stanza of the first half dealt with. The second stanza of the second part is verses 7 and 8. My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and make melody. Awake, my glory. Awake, O harp and lyre. I will awake the dawn. So this verse, this stanza, also deals with faithfulness and steadfastness. But this time, it's David's. Because God is faithful, David will also be faithful, and he will sing praise to God. The third stanza of part 2 is verses 9 and 10. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations. For your steadfast love is great to the heavens, your faithfulness to the clouds. So this stanza is like the first one in part 1. And that is, it is another cry to God, but this time it is a cry of thanksgiving and praise. So notice this, the second time around, each of the three themes is raised a notch or two higher. The tone of the psalm becomes strong and confident. And the reason is because the psalmist is focusing on God. I mean, he's actually hiding in God, it says in the first verse. So his focus is on God, not on his problems. The two stanzas that deal with David's enemies have a change in them. The concern that we see in the first half of the psalm gives way to confidence in the second half that the pit that his enemies dug for him, they will fall into themselves. The stanzas that deal with David's relationship with God also change. The first half of the psalm showed confidence, which was on a very high note, but it rises even higher in the second half. It moves David from just confidence to actually singing to God. Verses 7 and 8 say, my heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and make melody. The first stanza in part 1 and then the third stanza in part 2, which talk about the same thing, they are direct addresses to God. He's speaking directly to God. But the appeal for mercy in part 1 rises just to pure praise in part 2. Listen to verse 9 and 10 again. I will give thanks to you, O Lord, among the peoples. I will sing praises to you among the nations. For your steadfast love is great to the heavens, your faithfulness to the clouds. Now, verse 10 is not the first place that we see the words love and steadfastness or faithfulness. They are found in verse 3 as well. And in between verse 3 and verse 10, we see David's declaration. He believed this and he says, my heart is steadfast. And he repeats it twice, which is a Hebrew poetic device to add emphasis. Because God is faithful, David will be faithful. This makes verse 7 really the emotional focus of the psalm and really makes it the center of our application for today. So I would apply the psalm in this way. Are you faithful in this sense? Is your heart steadfast? Alexander McLaren has a sermon on verse 7 titled, The Fixed Heart. And he provides in this sermon some wise words and asks some searching questions. Listen to this for just a moment. For a fixed heart, I must have a fixed determination and not a mere fluctuating and soon broken intention. I must have a steadfast affection and not merely a fluttering love that, like some butterfly, lights now on this and now on that sweet flower, but which has a flight straight as a carrier pigeon to its cot, which shall bear me direct to God. And I must have a continuous realization of my dependence upon God and of God's sweet sufficiency going with me all through the dusty day. Ah, brethren, how unlike the broken, interrupted lines that we draw is our average Christianity fairly represented by such words as these of my text. Do they not rather make us burn with shame when we think that a man who lived in the twilight of God's revelation and was weighed upon by distresses such as wrung this psalm out of him should have poured out this resolve, which we who live in the sunlight and are flooded with blessings find it hard to echo with sincerity and truth? Fixed hearts are rare amongst the Christians of this day. Alexander McLaren died 110 years ago. But I think who would argue that the situation has improved even slightly in these last 100 years? Fixed hearts are rare. Steadfast hearts are rare among Christians of this day. Now, if you know the Psalms, you'll not be surprised to find a chorus calling for God to be exalted. And in Psalm 57, you find that in two places, verse 5 and again in verse 11. They are exactly the same. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. So David shares his plea for mercy, his description of his enemies, and all of that in part 1, and then speaks this chorus. And then in a more confident way in part 2, and repeats the chorus. And I want you to know, God is exalted above the heavens. And His glory does fill the earth. The goal of history is that God might be known as God and be honored for it. And nothing will frustrate the purposes of God. But this repeated chorus is not a statement that God has or will be exalted. This is a statement which is a prayer that He might be exalted. And that raises some questions. How so? And in what manner? And by whom is God to be exalted? Well, the answer to these questions is clearly that David wants God to be exalted in his own personal circumstances. And by the way, he trusts and praises Him even in difficulties. You see, the world thrills when human beings are exalted. Kings, presidents, rulers, statesmen, the rich and the famous, athletes, entertainers. But those who know God rejoice when God is exalted. And they rejoice that they have the great privilege of exalting Him themselves, especially in circumstances that are disappointing or hard. I think, friends, this may be the circumstances we find ourselves in today. Circumstances are difficult. For some, they're hard. For some, they're just inconvenient. In the whole spectrum, I don't want to describe just one and categorize it as terrible for everyone, but I also don't want to characterize it as only inconvenient when it's quite serious for some. But that may be where we find our place today. And so I guess my question is your heart steadfast? Are you committed to saying, "Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. Be exalted in my personal circumstances. I'm going to praise your name even during this difficult time." Let me leave you with just a few points of application or encouragement. If you're nervous, if you're anxious, or if you're just afraid, I want you to know that that is very real. It's real even in the lives of Christians. Peter tells us to cast our cares on the Lord, and the reason he does that is he assumes that we all have seasons of anxiety. If we didn't, he wouldn't have written it. 1 Peter 5:7 is the passage I'm referring to. It's very well known. Casting all of your anxieties on him because he cares for you. So my intent today is not to rebuke your anxiety or your fear, but to answer it with words of hope from Psalm 57. Secondly, I'd like to remind you that we were once slaves to fear, but the gospel rescues us from that slavery, and it reminds us that we now belong to an omnipotent God. Romans 8:15 says, "For you did not receive the spirit of slavery to fall back into fear, but you have received the spirit of adoption as sons, by whom we cry, Abba, Father." Thirdly, I'd like to tell you that this is a time, let me just encourage you to exercise trust in God, active trust in God. Trust in God is really the vaccine against the spread of fear. And you really only have to look at these Psalms to see that. If you flip back one chapter in Psalms to Psalm 56, verse 3, you'll read this. "When I am afraid, I put my trust in you, in God whose word I praise. In God I trust, I shall not be afraid." This present struggle that we're in will pass. But it's just a matter of time before another one comes. In preparation, let's be stewards of this current crisis. Let's use this time to learn. Let's use this time to train ourselves to trust in God. Let's use this to train ourselves to be compassionate. Maybe we need to train ourselves to be comforting, especially for those among us who need some extra care on this journey through the unknown. I don't know what the future holds. I don't know when the next time we'll meet together will be. I don't know who in our congregation will become ill. But I want to be able to repeat with David, "My heart is steadfast, O God. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and make melody." Thank you for watching this morning. We'll see you again next Sunday.